Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Trip Planner by Expedia. You were made to have strong opinions about sand. We were made to help you and your friends find a place on the beach with a pool and a marina and a waterfall and a soaking tub. Expedia. Made to travel.
With DashPass from DoorDash, get more to your door for less. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With no delivery fees and savings on every order. Dash that with DashPass from DoorDash. Start your 30-day free trial now. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Monday, the 29th of January. Three American troops are killed in an attack on the Jordanian-Syrian border, the first such death since the Gaza conflict began. The US blames Iranian-backed militants.
The three American service members we lost were patriots in the highest sense. We will hold all those responsible to account at a time and in a manner of our choosing.
Will this lead to a further escalation? There are hopes that a new deal between Israel and Hamas is moving closer after talks in Paris. And a blow for African unity as Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger quit ECOWAS. Also in the podcast, Finland's first presidential poll since it joined NATO is going to a second round. And
you're going to get caught, Griselda, or worse, and I don't want to be around to see it. Or what happens to your kids?
We speak to the lead character of the hit Netflix narco series, Griselda. As Israel's most important ally, the US is already a major player in the current conflict in the Middle East, sending ships to the region and carrying out strikes on targets in Yemen, Iraq and Syria. But now the American military has suffered its first deaths from enemy fire since the Gaza war began. In a written statement, the US President Joe Biden said three service personnel had been killed in an overnight drone attack on a small US outpost near the Jordanian-Syrian border, and he blamed Iranian-backed militants.
Today, America's heart is heavy. Jill and I join the families and friends of our fallen and Americans across the country in grieving the loss of these warriors in this despicable and wholly unjust attack. The three American service members we lost were patriots in the highest sense. We will carry on their commitment to fight terrorism, and have no doubt we will hold all those responsible to account at a time and in a manner of our choosing.
The words of Joe Biden. I heard more about the attack from our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
So this was a place called Tower 22. It's one of a cluster of American bases on the Syrian-Jordanian border, close to the quite sizable American base of Atamf, which is on the Syrian side, and which is a base that's been there since around 2016. These are bases where the US conducts counterterrorism, counter-narcotics operations, and do some training of Syrian opposition as well. It's an area where rebel groups, whether they are Iraqi or Syrian, have launched attacks at in the past. Atamf, I think, was hit back in October. But I think what is significant about this is that even though we have seen upwards of 150 attacks on American bases across Iraq and Syria and elsewhere in recent months, this is the first time any of those drone attacks have resulted in American fatalities. And that obviously puts the Americans in quite an interesting bind.
They're blaming Iranian-backed groups operating in Syria and Iraq, and they say they will respond. Could this lead to a serious escalation in the region?
It could, but the Americans have been dealing with these attacks for several months now. And this isn't just because of the war in Gaza. This is obviously a much longer story of opposition to American presence in Syria and Iraq. Those attacks have definitely escalated in recent months, and the Americans have launched a number of attacks as a result. And obviously this pits the Americans against, ultimately, Iran, which is the power that is backing these militant groups in Iraq and Syria. And so there is a danger there that two of the major powers could be sucked into something more significant. I think both sides are very keen to avoid that. there is frankly nothing in it for either the Americans or the Iranians to trigger a wider escalation. As we've seen, the Americans have been very keen since October to try and damp down the various regional tensions that have been spreading here, there and everywhere. This makes all of that more difficult. You've got the ongoing business with the Houthis in the Red Sea, another major headache for the Americans. But I think we will see the Americans doing what they have done before, which is to go after those they regard as responsible for these attacks, but try really hard not to escalate.
Our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams. Well, despite the threat of a possible escalation in the area, there are signs that a pause in the fighting in Gaza itself could be getting closer. Talks over a new truce in exchange for a release of more Israeli hostages have been held in the French capital, Paris, reportedly attended by intelligence chiefs from the US, Israel and Egypt. Israel said the discussions were constructive, but gaps remain. So what can we say about the talks so far? I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Mark Lowen.
We know that an Israeli delegation got to Paris on Sunday morning. We understand from other reports from the US that a US delegation will involve the head of the CIA, Bill Burns. We think that the Israeli delegation includes the head of Mossad, the Israeli spy agency. We think that his Egyptian counterpart is there and top officials from Qatar. But being a sort of a meeting of spies, as you'd expect, there's not very much publicly disclosed. We don't even know exactly where it's happening. Representatives of Hamas will be there, although the Israelis and Hamas don't speak directly. And what we understand is that the Israelis are mooting an idea of a two-month ceasefire, which there would be a phased release of all remaining Israeli hostages and those who have been killed. In exchange for them, Palestinian prisoners would be released from Israeli jails. Hamas has in the past said that any hostage release deal needs to involve a permanent ceasefire. So there is still a gulf between them, and of course a blood-soaked gulf. And we wait to see whether the regional mediators, particularly the Qataris, Egyptians, can bridge that gulf.
So obviously there are differences. Are there ways that they can be bridged?
One of the ways that it can be bridged is just the sort of growing narrative in this war, at which the Israeli government clearly is very aware of, the pressure that is being exerted by Israel's Western allies, the pressure that is being exerted by the families of the hostages to make significant progress on releasing these hostages. Today marks 3 months since the ground offensive began. And Israel has not really yet achieved its military aims. I mean, it says it has destroyed 9,000 combatants in Gaza. We have no way of knowing that. US intelligence is reported to have concluded that Israel's military achievements fall well short of that. And yet still, 130 or so hostages have not returned. Israel believes that about 28 of them might already be dead. That really deep wound, the missing hostages, is something that is motivating gradually the Israelis to re-engage in some kind of talks, realizing that perhaps that twin aim of total destruction of Hamas and getting the hostages back may not actually be achievable.
Mark Lowen in Jerusalem. Demonstrations against the far right have continued across Germany this weekend and even spread to Austria. The protest was sparked by revelations that far-right activists had attended a meeting which reportedly discussed the mass deportation of migrants and German citizens of foreign origins. The scandal has damaged the far-right Alternative for Deutschland party, which had been polling strongly in Germany. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports now from the city of Chemnitz in the state of Saxony.
A crowd gathers in Chemnitz city square. With help, Renata Aris slowly climbs stairs to the stage. In her 80s, she survived the Holocaust. Many of her Jewish family did not.
It's very important that we Jews raise our voice. The situation in Germany has become threatening because of Alternative for Deutschland and other far-right groups, not just for us Jews.
These demos were sparked by a report from the investigative outlet Corrective. It revealed that senior figures from the Alternative for Deutschland party met with right-wing extremists where the mass deportation of asylum seekers and so-called non-Germans was allegedly discussed. Also at the protest is the city's mayor, Sven Schulzer, a member of the German Chancellor's Social Democrats.
There's a debate about whether to ban the AfD. Where do you stand on that?
I'm against the ban of AfD. I think we have to tackle them on the political way, because if we ban them, I fear that more people try to support them.
The next day, the same square's now home to a market. Jana's selling plenty of honey, but says she's unhappy about the cost of living and cash being sent to Ukraine. The AfD's been polling at over 30% here in Saxony, and she's planning to vote for them.
They never had a chance to be in power because no one wants to work with them. Maybe if they got into power, it would be good for us.
There's been a lot of controversy around the AfD recently. Has that put you off at all?
In my view, no.
The AfD says it's being smeared, but the party in Saxony has been designated as extremist. In the halls of Chemnitz City Council, I meet Volker Dringenberg, the party's group leader here.
We believe that many of these demonstrators don't know our programme. We're in the absurd situation where people demonstrate with the government against the opposition. That's unheard of.
I'm in the centre of Chemnitz and stood by an enormous 40-foot-tall monument of Karl Marx's head. It is an unsubtle reminder we're in that part of Germany that was separated off from the West for decades. And still, to this day, some people carry a sense of being different somehow or looked down upon. And it's seen as a driver of the AfD's popularity here. The level of support will be tested in key elections later this year.
Jessica Parker in Germany. Police in Turkey have arrested two suspects after a man was killed during Sunday Mass at a Catholic church in Istanbul. The motive for the shooting wasn't immediately clear. Officials, though, said it looked like a targeted assassination. The church is located about 20 kilometres north of the city's main tourist sites. I heard more from our correspondent in Istanbul, Ola Guerin.
Well, this was a very chilling attack and it was captured on CCTV. First of all, you see two masked gunmen who are walking, strolling actually, towards the church very calmly. Then you see footage from inside the church. The congregation are already on their feet, mass is underway, people are facing towards the altar. At the back of the church, you see one man come in and he is followed almost immediately by the two attackers who appear to target him directly. At this stage, as bullets are ringing out in the church, members of the congregation are ducking for cover, and the Interior Ministry is saying that the two suspects in the case have now been arrested. There's been a statement from the Interior Minister congratulating the police, who he described as heroic, and expressing sympathy to the family of the victim. There has also been a claim reported on the media from IS claiming that they carried out the attack. Now, at this stage, that is unverified. But at the end of last year, the authorities here arrested about 30 people who they claimed were associated with IS, and they said that they had been carrying out reconnaissance with the aim of attacking places of worship of Christians and Jews in Istanbul. But so far, we have no confirmation that this was IS or that these two suspects were in any way linked with that group who were arrested at the end of last year. Turkey has a history of violent attacks, including large-scale attacks that have been carried out by Islamic State. And there is also a history here of attacks on the Christian minority from time to time. Now, at the scene today, local officials were keen to stress to us that in the neighbourhood, there were good relations between people of different faiths, and they said there was no tension, and they even said that Muslims in the area had visited the church as well as Christians. It is certainly the case that Christians in Turkey have been targeted in the past. Pope John Paul today rushed to offer his sympathies to the community, saying that he felt very close to the congregation.
Ola Guerin in Istanbul. The infamous Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar apparently once said, "The only man I was ever afraid of was a woman named Griselda Blanco." Blanco, known as the cocaine godmother, ran a huge drug ring in Miami in the 70s and 80s, importing narcotics from her native Colombia. Now, the story of this female drug lord in a male-dominated world is being told in a TV series on Netflix. Blanco is portrayed by fellow Colombian actress Sofia Vergara.
For the last 3 years, Griselda Blanco has owned Miami, distributing cocaine
I grew up in Colombia during the narco-traffic era. We all knew the drug dealers' names, you know, Pablo Escobar de Ochoa. We knew who they were, how they even looked. And I had never heard of this woman. So when I was in the United States already living and I first heard of her, I was like, there was a Colombian woman, you know, that was able to get to that level.
Ms. Blanco's operation has been efficient, deadly, and incredibly successful.
I think because she was a woman, she was able to get away with a lot because nobody was expecting that a woman was part of this crazy, only men-dominated business.
I know what I'm doing.
I thought it was the perfect character for me because I'm Colombian, I'm a mother, I'm an immigrant, and I lived through the narco-traffic era, so I'm like, I know what this person is.
I moved cocaine for 10 years, Medellin to New York, and you have no idea what I have gone through since.
It was important for all of us to make Griselda not just like one-sided, complete monster from the beginning, but to make people relate to her, understand what she was coming from.
What's up?
Came to see how the house hunting's going. Find a place?
Not yet. The most crazy thing for me was that it was a mother that cared about her friends and she wanted to help them, but that she could have that other side.
Come on, your business won't survive without this money. You're gonna get caught, Griselda, or worse, and I don't want to be around to see it. Or what happens to your kids?
What we really wanted to capture more was how she turned into this. This was like a small, delicate kind of girl when she started. A woman that had a lot of trauma and abuse when she was young. It was a woman that went through so much.
This is supposed to be the país de los sueños.
One of the most important things to do, Griselda, was that I wanted to do it in Spanish and in English, supporting the Latin American actors.
Can I sell you a kilo?
You know, sometimes we don't get opportunities to be in productions of this size with Netflix. And for me to be able, as a producer, to open doors for these actors, most of them, they would love to have managers and agents in Hollywood. I hope this is going to change their lives and their career the same way that Modern Family changed mine.
After all that I have been through, I'm not going to give it away for nothing.
Actress Sofia Vergara on playing the lead role in the new Netflix series Griselda. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Def Jam is the Motown of rap. It's the primary significant label that foreshadows all that came after.
40 years since the hip-hop revolution. When the Economic Community of West African States was set up in 1975, Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger were all founding members. But after a series of coups in recent years, they've all been suspended from the trading bloc, with Mali and Niger also facing heavy sanctions. Now the three nations have said they are pulling out of ECOWAS for good. I heard why from our Africa regional editor, Andrew Ocheng.
They're saying it's been taken up by foreign ideologies. It's not been helping them fight the jihadists. It's not been helping them with the security situations. And then there's the problem of the sanctions they're complaining about, because since the coups, ECOWAS has imposed sanctions on the three countries, saying that they have to restore civilian rule and their assets in the ECOWAS central bank have been frozen. They can't borrow money from the regional body. Some regional banks which operate in Niger have suspended their activities there. Nigeria cut power to Niger. So some of these things are affecting individuals in these countries. Just after the coup, when these sanctions were imposed, we were reporting issues about lack of food, lack of power, and people can't get enough money out of the banks because of these sanctions. So they are affecting people on the ground. And then there's the issue of insecurity. They're saying ECOWAS is not helping them fight Islamist jihadists in their countries.
Yeah, ECOWAS, quite an important trading bloc. What will be the long-term impact of the departure of these three countries if they do go through with it?
ECOWAS is saying, first of all, that they haven't received any formal notification of this departure. So we don't know the technicalities of how they're going to leave and what is going to happen after they leave. Remember, there are also other countries which are involved in this and which been sort of trying to get back to ECOWAS. You remember, these three countries have also been suspended from the AU because of
the African Union.
Yes, the African Union, that is, like Guinea, for example. So some of these countries have not said what they want to do, but it's affecting the credibility of ECOWAS. Remember, when the coup happened, ECOWAS had been giving ultimatums saying within 48 hours, if you don't restore civilian rule, if you don't release the president, Mohamed Bazoum, we're going to come in with military and do all these things. And they never did anything.
If ECOWAS's threats so far haven't had any impact on changing the attitudes of these coup leaders, is there anything they can do to try to bring them back to come round the table again?
It doesn't seem anything so far other than accept the coups. But now there's the danger of, if you start accepting coups, then analysts are calling it the coup belt. It might start affecting other countries in the entire part of Africa. So there are sentiments within those countries that made an excuse for these coups to take place in the first place. And now if ECOWAS doesn't seem to be listening to these issues, it could be problematic as well.
Our Africa regional editor, Andrew Ocheng. France has become the 10th nation to suspend payments to the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, after Israel said several members of the agency's staff were involved in the deadly Hamas attacks of the 7th of October. The UN chief has appealed for funding to continue after major donors like the US, Britain and Germany pulled their financial support. Other big donors like Norway will continue to send money, as the Norwegian foreign minister, Espen Barth Eide, explained to Tim Franks.
We are as appalled and shocked by these very serious allegations about local staff of UNRWA having possibly taken part in terrorist attacks. That is 100% unacceptable, and we need a full investigation of that. However, to react to that by cutting all funding to UNRWA, which is providing life-saving support to millions of people in the most dire conditions of their life, I think is a very wrong response. So I agree with the Secretary General that we should not do that. We should keep the funding, and we should also support the leadership to get to the bottom of this case.
I guess the problem is, though, for donor countries, and it's the case that's been made by many inside Israel for some time, is that it's extremely difficult in a place like Gaza, under which Hamas has exerted such a grip over many years, to be certain that money that is going in for humanitarian relief is actually being spent on the civilians who need it rather than the militants who might take it.
That critique has been there for a long time and it should be taken seriously. But remember that these concrete allegations are not about money transfers. They are about local employees who have taken part in the terrorist attacks on 7th of October, totally unrelated to their work in UNRWA. That is unacceptable, but it's not a question of diversion of funds. It's about what they did outside of their job. These people have been dismissed immediately as investigations are going on, as they should. There are 30,000 employees in UNRWA altogether. It's the biggest vehicle of life-saving support to millions of people, including in Gaza. And the vast majority of these people are at the risk of their life, delivering incredibly important support for people in very difficult circumstances. 140 plus of these people have been killed in airstrikes or in fighting over since the 7th of October. The vast majority have nothing to do with this violence. But to have an absolute zero risk situation is very difficult when these people are so embedded into society, which is why UNRWA and the UN now needs to identify, you know, whether these allegations are true, which they might be, and to prevent that this happens again. My point is that donors withdrawing support from UNRWA in this extremely critical situation where people are dying in the hundreds every day is not the right response. These people are not refugees because they wanted to be refugees. They are refugees because the world community has not been able to solve the Palestinian question.
The Norwegian Foreign Minister Espen Barth Eide talking to Tim Franks. Well, Einat Wilf is a former member of the Israeli Parliament, the Knesset, and a long-term critic of UNRWA. What does she make of the UN Secretary-General saying he's horrified by allegations of UNRWA staff being involved in the attacks of the 7th of October, but at the same time calling for funding to continue because it is so badly needed?
He should be horrified by the continued existence of UNRWA, a still temporary agency after more than seven decades that has been hijacked by the Arab refugees themselves, now cast as Palestinians, for the singular purpose of keeping the war of 1948 as an open case until they win it to their cause of no Jewish state. That is the deep purpose of UNRWA. Everything else it does is marginal to this purpose.
I know it's not a statement that is that unusual in some quarters, particularly in Israel, but this UN agency provides critical aid for Palestinians even when there isn't a war. I mean, right now, they are literally a lifeline for around 2 million Palestinian civilians in Gaza.
It's actually a complete reversal of cause and effect. First of all, it's important to know that thanks to UNRWA, Palestinians are some of the most educated and enjoying some of the best healthcare and education in the Arab world. But the reversal of cause and effect is that the agency has been hijacked for the purpose of keeping the Arab refugees in perpetual refugeehood, because they understood that if they would be settled, they would essentially be accepting that the Jewish state remains. And to them, that was unacceptable. So everything that UNRWA does is in the service of keeping the war of 1948 open. You could provide those services in a variety of ways, not least of which the Palestinians could actually finally be told that they need to be responsible for themselves, rather than being kept as a people constantly waiting for the Jewish state not to exist and fighting to bring it about.
Essentially, you're saying that these people are refugees because it is in their interest to be refugees. They would argue that the reason that they are refugees is because there is no resolution to the conflict.
But it's reversal of cause and effect.
No, and I understand it is a valid... Einat, if I could just ask a quick question. Right now, in the middle of a war, when you have got people who are utterly desperate, most of them are surviving on barely any food, for several countries to suspend funding of the major agency with the prospect that funding could run out within days, that is a humanitarian emergency which surely supersedes everything else.
Again, we have arrived at the current moment because UNRWA for decades has kept Palestinians in a suspended limbo to be a people fighting for one thing only, to destroy the Jewish state. The moment that they understand that they can live next to the Jewish state rather than instead of it, that they are not into the fifth generation refugees from Palestine, but rather already living in Palestine, that they can build for themselves, then they should get all the money in the world. I think all the donor countries should give Palestinians 10 times what they're giving them. But first, they need to hear from Palestinians that they have finished their century-long war, and then Gaza can prosper.
Einat Wilf talking to Tim Franks. Finland's presidential election will go to a runoff. With almost all votes counted, the candidate of the main governing National Coalition Party, Alexander Stubb, is leading. The centre-right politician has won more than a quarter of the votes so far, well under the 50% needed for outright victory. Danny Eberhard has more details.
This was an election in which the nine candidates broadly agreed on the main issue. They all promised to take a tough stance against Moscow amid security concerns unleashed by Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Following the first round vote, Alexander Stubb, a former prime minister, will face off against Pekka Haavisto, a Green politician standing as an independent, in 2 weeks' time. As the country's former foreign minister, Mr. Haavisto helped steer Finland through to NATO membership last year. Finland and Russia share a long border, and Helsinki blamed Moscow for orchestrating an influx of irregular migrants towards the end of last year. That prompted the Finns to close the border entirely.
Danny Eberhard. Farmers in France say they plan to cut off access to Paris in their latest protests on Monday. They say they'll set up roadblocks on all the main motorways into the capital. They've already gained some concessions after demonstrations in the south of the country last week. There's been similar action in Germany, Belgium and the Netherlands amid complaints of falling incomes, rising bureaucracy and unfair competition. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
After a lull over the weekend, France's farmer protests look set to hot up again, with the focus now no longer the south, but the much more politically sensitive terrain of the capital itself. The main farmers' unions are warning of a military-style operation, with hundreds of tractors manoeuvring into place from early afternoon to stop traffic on all the motorways leading into Paris. Their aim is to stop deliveries of food to supermarkets, and thus, if possible, get the buying urban public to feel a little of the pinch. The government is unlikely to do much to stop them. The farmers' cause is a popular one, and police have not intervened once so far to lift any of the roadblocks elsewhere in the country. But the Interior Minister said that Paris's airports would be kept open and tractors would not be allowed into the capital itself.
Hugh Schofield in the French capital. It is 40 years since the record label Def Jam shook up music by bringing hip-hop and rap to the world. Jacqueline Springer is a music journalist and curator of Africa and Diaspora Performance at the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London. She's been telling Johnny Diamond how Def Jam changed the world of music and why rap still matters.
Def Jam is the Motown of rap. It's the primary significant label that foreshadows all that came after. Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective. They executed the passage of rap out of New York and into the world.
Is there a breakthrough sound, a single, a breakthrough album where rap and hip-hop is commercially embraced?
With Def Jam, LL Cool J, Can't Live Without My Radio. You want the gold, but I know I can't live without my radio. This 16-year-old just comes out and he's telling you that radio and the music that is pumped out of it is his lifeblood. But then you have groups like Public Enemy with the production technique of Hank Shockley, who distorts sound and it creates this cavernous, thunderous underbelly beat upon which you have two very distinct rappers, primarily Chuck D, who's commanding. Sometimes, is he actually speaking? Is he pulpit based in telling you that life looks like this for young black people in inner cities across the United States, but also across the world? Those two examples are in direct sonic and performative contrast to the Beastie Boys. No sleep till! Who utilize the jaggedness and the discordant rebellion of rock, and they are also like the Three Stooges. They purposefully find everything witty, silly, and they also exploit and dance on the moral values of the times.
Those who didn't like it and didn't like its message were pretty harsh on what they saw as the adoration of drugs and crime and the degradation of the role of women. Has that moved on?
It's one of the abiding oppositional narratives against rap, as it has been against rock and roll, heavy metal. It's about dominantly male art form that seeks to narrate the ideal, to amass as much money, to have sexual relations without any responsibility, to reputationally and sometimes lyrically threaten rivals in different ways. Who shot you? Separate the weak from the ox. Leap hard
to creep them Brooklyn streets. It's on again. Stop all that bickering. Is the creative energy still there 40 years on?
Yes, it absolutely is. Now and again, some people emerge that absolutely capture the time and take you somewhere else musically and intellectually. So you can have somebody like Kendrick Lamar. I said I do this for my culture, to let you know what it look like in a bulletproof Rover. In my mama's soul. Or you can have somebody like Andre 3000 recently releasing an album that isn't a rap album at all. But he's able to actually cultivate this because he's a musical being who utilized rap as his primary means of musical expression. But you've also got younger artists like Ice Spice, whose linguistic play is deliberately slow, very languid in her tales of, you know, romantic concern and contempt. Damn.
Jacqueline Springer talking to Johnny Diamond.
And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast very soon. This one was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.